I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
I'm Tim McIntosh.
And I'm Sean Johnson.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are discussing Hernan Diaz's novel Trust. We're discussing part three, a memoir remembered by Ida Pratenza. That's part three. That means we can also talk about parts one and two in some greater depth.
Oh, thank God.
But first, I'm noticing all three of you are wearing glasses. And
yes,
you're all wearing similar styles of glasses. And I'm feeling a little left out.
Well,
Heidi, the glasses are relatively new for you, right?
They're so new for me. I've never had glasses before my whole life. I have this like weird monovision when I have one eye that is nearsighted and one eye that's farsighted. Mm. And so together, they've always been the perfect 20/20 vision. But just this year, my eyes are starting to decline. Mm. So now I have reading glasses for all my work on the computer.
Last episode, we were talking about her birthday. Now we're talking about how she's declining.
It's just my eyesight.
Oh, okay. All right. The rest of everything else is
everything else is ship shape.
Okay.
I had to get glasses in the fourth grade, so maybe you're getting younger.
Maybe so. Yeah. I like that idea a lot.
Tim, when did you have to get your glasses?
My favorite.
I got them when I was 42, so last year.
Oh, so maybe I just aged very early.
Oh, okay. Last year, okay. So you two...
that was not true, but that was
I was just going to go with it. Have you always had, have you had glasses forever, Tim?
You're talking to me or Heidi?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I did not have glasses at all. I noticed how exhausted I would be before I got glasses. And I just thought I was kind of losing steam. And then I got my eyes checked. And the woman who was helping me is like, so is this a replacement pair? No. Oh, it should be a replacement pair. You needed glasses. And I started having energy all of a sudden at 4:00 in the afternoon. Because I could, anyway.
You could see.
So
it's a drain.
Previously,
your energy.
Were things blurry?
They were. But I was just like muscling through. I could keep reading. Because, it happens so slowly that you don't really notice until you're like, wait a second. This isn't the way it was 3 years ago or whatever.
You were trying
to bend
reality for a while there.
I kind of like them, though. I feel like I'm, when I put them on, I feel like very scholarly.
Yes.
I'm about to read case files to solve murders or do some research. This is probably what Ida Pratenza did when she
probably
was looking at the Bevel papers. She put on her glasses. She's wearing a sweater.
Mm-hmm. That was a David Caliber transition.
Thank you.
I just want to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well
really
done.
Impressive.
We do need to talk about, Ida Pratenza and her memoir Remembered and what it tells us about the rest of the book. Sean, you have never read this before, except now you have.
True. Yeah, right.
I was thinking about you while reading it again.
Yeah. Thank you.
Did you find that this section clarified things for you, clarified things that were questions for you after reading the first two parts? Do you come out of this section being like, oh, okay.
I think that one or another of you, or maybe all of you combined, intimated that this would happen in part three. But I both had things clarified for me and then had other questions that emerged and or deepened for me. But I think I did come to, there was one moment where things all kind of clicked and I realized what was going on. And I almost threw the book. That was so... electric that moment. No way! What?
What was that moment?
Well, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it was the moment when Ida is telling us about reading books and then talking to her father about them over the dinner table, which is immediately recognizable as a scene from part two. And at that moment, it all sort of came together, and I realized where this was going, and it was very exciting. But of course the mystery, there are two mysteries of trust, I think, that are much clearer now. And that's who Mildred is. The answer to that question isn't clearer, but it's more obvious that that is the central mystery. But also why Harold Vanner wrote his book. That is seems to be the other question that I demand part four answer for me. What's this guy up to?
As soon as you said that, I looked right at David's face to see what expression crossed it.
What expression crossed it?
Kind of like a gleam of...
I'm not wearing glasses, so something she could see something across it.
I don't know what the word is. What's the word for like a
knowing gleam?
Yeah, like maybe, but like a gleam of happy comradeship with Sean.
Oh, nice. Okay.
I'm so glad you asked type of thing.
Wow. Yes.
Great.
And yet we can't talk about it this week.
The grin of brotherhood.
Yeah, yes. Like a smile of fraternity. Or a connection.
The smile one of simpatico.
Those, what, you two? I thought I was the only one.
I have, yes, Sean, I have extensive thoughts on this. Theories, even, which we will get to. But alas, we can't really talk about them until after we talk about part four.
All right. Because
you were demanding the part four answer.
Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Dying.
But are there other questions besides those ones that...
No, I mean, those, by the end of part three, it's obvious that's what this book is about. Or it feels like that's what this book is about. Maybe part four will change that all for me again.
Okay, well, let me ask you this, and then Heidi and Tim jump in at any point. Sean, do you feel like you know more about who Bevel/Rask is?
Yes. I think I know Bevel a lot better now. Yeah. I'm just going to say yes. I have few or no qualifications.
Few or no qualifications.
If we're talking about Mr. Right, we're talking about Mr. Yeah, Andrew.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems much clearer who he is now.
Who is he?
I'd have to write a book to answer. Maybe three books.
Yeah,
too
exactly.
Bad Hernan Diaz didn't write that book.
Yeah, right. I mean, it seems maybe this could be naive, but it seems like we're allowed a fairly candid look at him in what he reveals of himself and then what Ida Partenza sort of thinks and concludes about him.
Heidi, go ahead. What were you going to say? You just had a look come across your face.
Well, I think I respectfully disagree, Sean.
Ooh. Now,
which
okay,
doesn't really happen between you and me very often.
It's true. And you have more information than I do, but let me clarify and see if you still disagree.
Yeah.
Because this will just help me. I guess what I mean is that we are given enough information here, not that he presents a faithful version of himself, or even that Ida by herself does, but that we get enough information to infer a lot about who he really is. But maybe even that's not true. I guess
Well, I don't know that I think it's not true. I think that this time, as I'm reading it, I find him even more mysterious than her.
Interesting.
Than her being Mildred or being Ida?
Being Mildred, yeah.
Okay.
Ida, in my opinion, is not mysterious at all. That girl is.
No, no, no.
She has things to say. And she is writing this section because she has felt stifled by the patriarchy, right? And
she finally gets to tell her story.
Yes. And if we take her at face value, then I think we have no more mysteries about Bevel, about Andrew Bevel.
Yeah. Yeah, but she has reduced him to a particular idea in her mind. Yeah,
she cannot be trusted.
Nah.
We don't have any other perspective on her. Yeah. Then the mystery deepens, right? And I was actually ranting about this to David last night via text, and concluded that I find him very mysterious because his portrayal so far is universally negative. And that is curious to me. Everybody is humanized, and the only way to humanize him is to read between the lines. Even part two, which we have a lot more insight into through Ida, was written by Ida, who dislikes and distrusts him, but still wants his approval, and he is this like magnet figure for all of her issues with American democracy, American prosperity, and her father. So she's both representing him and indicting him at the same time.
Yeah.
And so, and therefore, go ahead, David.
I was just going to say, and therefore most of the things that we complained about in part two as being criticisms of him can be just as easily read as criticisms of her. Like, we could complain about her the way she seems to not really care about Mildred, or to, you know, all those little asides, like, talk more about this, that feel like they're just slipped in there for the sake of slipping them in there. We can blame her for those as much as we can blame him for those.
Do I think he's some kind of like misunderstood teddy bear? No, I do not. I do not think he's the hero of the story, but nor am I. I have been so forced down my throat that he's the villain that I am. I don't trust that. That's the title of the book. I don't trust it.
Tim, what do you think of this part? So it's a general question, but this is your second time reading it. So I figured I'd leave it open.
I'm really wrestling right now. I'm going to duck your question. And I'm really wrestling with what Heidi just said, because I have read this part. I agree. I think there's a way that you can read back into part two as sort of like Ida, the anti-capitalist who is so sophisticated with her pen that she can undermine even while she self-aggrandizes, you know, with the parrot mouth of Andrew Bevel. I'm really open to that. I'm a little bit reluctant because, man, she got to get paid. She's got to get paid, right? And, oh gosh, I think that if we can't trust her pretty deeply, the book starts to wobble. And the book really starts to wobble. And here's what remains to be answered. Does section four ratify Ida Partenza's viewpoint, or chip away at her viewpoint? That can be like a question, I guess, for next week, but that's a question for me. What did I think of part three? So maybe I should just like stop there.
Well, I'll just say that I think that Hernan Diaz is using that desire for us to feel what you just said against ourselves in a way. Like, I think he knows that we want part four, that we want each part to ratify or deny the previous section. We want it to give us more answers. And so when you come to it, you're reading it as if these are going to be more clues to solve the mystery that has been presented in the previous part. And so he does that with part two in a way. It sharpens the mystery of part one. It creates the same character almost being a foil for it against itself in a way, and then inserts new points of view and suggestions of what's actually true about each of these characters. And then part three, I think it deepens that in some ways.
And so you think, David, structurally the book is kind of almost a snake that's going to eat its own tail, because number two undermines, or it's a kind of counter to part one. Three is a counter to part two. And I'm not sure that I agree with that assessment structurally, because I don't know that number two, how do I say this? I read part two, the autobiography of Andrew Bevel, to be just a self-protecting attempt to undermine public reputation. He has a lot to lose here. I don't know what Ida has to lose. I don't know what Ida, what her motives would be other than doing the job that she was set out to do, unless she is somehow like come around to her father's side and she's like, yeah, man, these capitalists, they're awful. Down with, not just down with the patriarchy, but down with the moneyed elite, specifically this clown on, you know, living in his five-story bunker. I think I'm a little bit more trusting of her.
Well, I think that's the question of the novel. Like, where do we as the reader put our trust? And in that sense, I think we have multiple opportunities to interpret. I think what you said is really important, Tim, that the book starts to wobble if you can't put some kind of weight down on something, like some kind of narrative.
Right. Maybe not Ida, thread. But maybe part four. Right. You've got to put your foot down somewhere.
And I think that I think we can trust the timeline. I think we can trust like the plot, right? I think we can say like she didn't make up that what happened with Jack or with her dad and with the knife and, you know, those things. I think what we are invited to, and I think encouraged to distrust or question, query, are the character's self-interpretations and interpretations of the events. And I think we see with Ida, either this is a straightforward, straight up anti-patriarchy, feminist, stick it to the man, right? Like Andrew Bevel and the big bad American capitalists, which frankly is a narrative that is easily accepted in the public square today. Like, this is subtle if Hernan Diaz is going to give us that, because you can walk away from this novel at any point being like, Andrew Bevel's rune, the Andrew Bevels of the world are taking down civilization, right? but I think we're given enough of Ida's hangups, her anger, her rage, and her vindictiveness against the men in her life, from her father to Jack, and her self-justifications of that, that I think we can easily question her interpretations of Andrew Bevel. That are, and then what that means is that every single section up to now has been Andrew Bevel from somebody else's perspective who doesn't like what he stands for.
To Tim's point, I suppose the question remains, why she's still taking his story and then rewriting, and why does he seem like he's okay with the pages?
Right. He approves what she writes.
But the key here is that it's never revised. It's never finished. It's never completed. And therefore his version of the story, which is told through her pretending to be Calvin Coolidge and Henry Ford and, you know, all these different people, is essentially a incomplete list of the things that he wants to defend. And I actually think he comes across way better in this section than you guys might, but that's a different conversation for a different day. And I'm going to hold that for the next episode.
It's hard. We're like in section three of four. We're like tiptoeing around it. David, one of the things that I was most interested in regarding this section was the foil of Ida's father as this anti-capitalist anarchist who is just as intolerable as Andrew Bevel is.
That's right. Yeah,
that's right.
Right. And he is,
which is why I think Bevel comes across a little better.
Interesting.
Go on, Tim.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, like, maybe by juxtaposition, yeah. But it seems like it's a little bit of an indictment of, maybe of men. That's probably overstating it.
I don't think maybe that's overstating it.
You don't think so?
Yeah. Every man in her story is
some kind of like wicked Pygmalion trying to like bend women to their image, right?
Or erase them.
And she is standing as, like, she perceives herself as standing in the gap for Mildred, who represents herself.
Well, yeah, she can't do anything else because she doesn't know Mildred. She says over and over,
Mildred would have wanted me to steal this. She would have wanted me to have this, right? I'm going to speak for her. I do find Ida off-putting, but I also find Andrew off-putting. Nobody is the hero of this story. There is no like hidden turn. It's just about our perceptions and interpretations of the events that we're given. Yeah. And an invitation for us to say, I, as the reader, the book becomes this mirror, right? I, as the reader, trust this, but not this. Which really comes down to because I want to. Hmm. And I think that is part of what the book is trying to open up in us as readers, is that kind of self-knowledge to us. There's the metafiction piece. What are the stories we tell ourselves? How do we interpret the stories of our lives and the stories of other people's lives? And are we even aware we're doing it?
I think that's what makes this book subtle, is because most of the characters are what they're saying. The truth is more likely to be between the lines than in the actual things they're saying, including the way they perceive of themselves, as you said. And can we actually trust our assessment of ourselves is an interesting question that I think this book is asking, which then means that we have to decide, can we trust, as the reader, can we trust these characters' assessments of themselves, let alone the other people? And then can we assess ourselves on whether we can trust the people in the books and how they trust themselves and the people around them? Go ahead, Tim. You're looking pensive.
Well, I just don't... Okay, I'll make my assertion. I think at the end of section four, I'll back up. Some of the best books that we've done on this show are when we're not just talking about the book, but we're talking about what genre are we reading? And through that, and that becomes like a central question, because the meaning of the book can shift whether or not this book in particular is a mystery novel in which we have a solution at the end of chapter four, or whether it's sort of like 1990 REM lyrics, make of them what you will. Who is Driver 8? Well, what do you think Driver 8 is? I think that's the other kind of like genre option in front of us. And I think part four answers the question somewhat definitively, and I'm not going to ruin it, but I think it is...
You think it tells us what genre it is?
I think it tells us what genre it is. And I think that the book is... I do not deny at all that these are perspectival sections. I mean, like, anybody can see that. But I don't think the perspectival approach is the genre. I think that it is a mystery that we're seeking to solve. I think part four solves it. And, also, and I'll go further. I think that if we read it as a perspectival genre, I think the book actually loses power. I think it's more powerful as a genre.
And yeah, that's a form, not a genre. I think that's right. That's the question that I was asking myself at this point, was whether this isn't just a mystery novel. I mean, mystery novels have been referenced obliquely throughout, and obviously we've already been forced to talk about the mystery.
I'm open to a page right now of the novel. With extensive lines about this.
The mystery? What are we solving? That's the
genius of it. The mystery is, what's the mystery? But maybe the mystery is like, what's the truth? I mean, that's sort of,
and I
vague.
Think
about
it, when we can't say it here, but I think when we get to four, we're like, oh, the mystery all along was X. Like, because the book just like the focus of the book for me goes from, boy, it's fuzzy after one, it's fuzzy after two, after three, it's less fuzzy. I feel like we've got traction at the end of three.
Yeah.
And for me, at the end of four, I'm like, Oh my gosh. It was right there in front of me the whole time.
Mildred and Harold Vanna were having an affair. Of course.
How did you know? You guessed it, Sean. How did you know?
Oh, man. I gotta read the end of this book.
This will be, I mean, like, this is like the fun of our next podcast is like, we'll all like come to the table.
And, it's true, but let's not do that yet. So we're here at three.
So one of the things that I thought of throughout this section was like several pop culture touch points. I was reminded of Orson Welles and the trouble he had making Citizen Kane because William Randolph Hearst was, you know, buying up theaters to force them to not show the movie and crazy things like that. But then also one of my favorite episodes of Seinfeld, where Jay Peterman, the owner of the clothing catalog, wants to write his own autobiography, but he doesn't have any interesting stories to tell. So he meets Kramer and he hears Kramer telling these fantastical stories about his own life, and he wants to buy them. He offers to buy Kramer's stories from him and pretend they're his own. And after the money changes hands and Kramer makes this agreement, he starts to regret it. So he's making this desperate grasp to sort of reclaim his life stories as his own. He starts an unofficial tour, taking people around New York City and showing him where the things that Jay Peterman says about himself actually happened to him.
In a fleece-lined tundra jacket, we crossed Central Park. Yeah.
Have you guys ever...
The sky was cloudy that day.
Have you ever read Muriel Spark's book, Loitering with Intent?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Where Fleur Talbot is a novelist, and she's trying to finish this novel, and she gets a job working for the Autobiographical Association, and it's all these eccentric people who want to write their memoirs, but they don't have real stories, and so essentially they end up... She's like editing them and helping them. She's doing what Ida's doing here. She's helping them write them and turn them into something that's not just terrible. And then she starts realizing that parts of her novel are ending up in their stories, in their novel, in their memoirs. They just like pulled them out of what she had written in her, because they needed better stuff. And then it involves blackmailing and all that kind of stuff. Very, very funny book. What does that have to do with this book though? Where were you going with that?
I don't know where I was going with that. Those were just the things I was thinking.
I think it has a lot to do with the way,
especially that callback at the end of part three, where Ida sort of resentfully, but she's also bewildered by it, hears her own life stories. Like, she has offered up stories from her own life to make Mildred seem more real. And then she hears them repeated back to her with no irony whatsoever, right? Bevel's telling her as if he really doesn't remember that she made this up, how his wife used to read him mystery novels. And
so how do you guys read that scene? Do you read that as just straightforward, like exactly what she's saying?
We're talking about the mystery novel thing.
I think the dinner at the end.
The dinner at the end where they're talking,
her idea,
and he acts like he lived that, and she's it was in her.
So I think this is like, does Andrew Bevel have any self at all? Capital S self.
Yeah.
Right. Does he have some kind of independent identity that is not either a story he is telling to the world, an image he's projecting, or a story someone is telling about him? And we don't have a single touch point for that that is not interpreted with some kind of judgment, either good or bad, by himself or others. And the fact that he is telling back this story to the person who told him the story is either like ineffably tragic or like wicked. He is either a villain or a fool, according to this narrative that we are given of him. And I think the easy answer, and I think Hernan Diaz is playing on our sensibilities with how easy it is to write Bevel off. And so in a sense, we become complicit, But we do have enough within the story to say, this is a man without a self.
Yeah.
So last night when Heidi and I were texting, she asked me, I don't know if you were at, I think you were just putting this out there for hypothetically, you know, for the sake of conversation. Is he always a villain or a fool? Or is he just like symbolic of something? And I do think that's one of the questions the book wants us to think about, it because it suggests too often that he is either foolish or he's villainous, depending on who you ask. Tim, what do you think? I mean, maybe he really is just symbolic of, you know, like money, mythology, you know?
I read that section not as Andrew Bevel lacking a self, which I think he does. I don't think he has a self. I read it as he did not know his wife, or he wanted his wife to be a certain way.
Oh, yeah.
And so he is pasting things onto her that never existed, or that existed in a different person's life.
But he's telling the person who told him that story.
Right.
So not as only is he projecting it onto Mildred, he's also projecting that onto the person that really happened to.
So my question is,
remembering that at all.
Is it as simple as that he just doesn't remember that she told him that in the first place, or that she put it in the book, and so then
her, like daring her to challenge his interpretation? Is he daring her to take back her own story, which would be a villainous thing to do?
Yeah. Now, here's my question. And
I just think there's like, Tim, there is a hole in, there is a, how do I say it? Andrew wants his wife to be a certain way. He's hired this woman to write a story about her. And these little stories that Ida tells really sync up with who Andrew wanted his wife to be.
Right.
So I think it's just, I actually did not read that as it's malicious, but a negligence.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I want her to be this way.
Our question is, why would it? I understand why he would make up stories about Mildred. That seems really obvious.
Right.
He's pygmalioning her after her death. Right. He's turning her into the image he wanted her to be.
Yeah, but he
he's
also
casting
is trying
her out of a block of marble. But hold on. But my question is to you is, actually, he's telling Ida the story of her life as if it was Mildred. Why is he doing that? That has to be either he's a fool or a villain, or right?
Can he be negligent?
That means he forgot. That makes him a fool. That means he forgot that it actually happened to Ida.
I think there's a third possibility. So that scene was my favorite part of book three.
Yeah, it was great.
And that moment introduced these possibilities that either he is totally doddering at this point. Right? I think it's about an earlier dinner, but she says, right, even him eating soup made him look feeble.
He's about to die.
He's about to die.
Yeah, so he just forgot. Yeah.
Or he is a villain. Or, and I think this third alternative maybe has different elements to it, that he's just partly naive. Even his motivation for these stories about Mildred could be interpreted charitably if you imagine him not as someone who is trying to reinvent his wife the way he wants her, but someone who finally realizes he has not paid enough attention to this wife that he has lost. Right? He says he can't offer concrete examples of things she liked because he didn't have time for them. What if he really just wants a wife to remember in the only way that he can get at it now? And in this sense, right, he feels, because of the way that he relates to money in an unhealthy and selfless / soulless kind of way, he really just has no distinction between what was true before and what you have paid for to be true now. Right? Like, I bought this story. Money changed hands. Of course it's my story now. It's my life. That's my wife. I paid you to make a wife for me.
It's a transaction. A story is a transaction.
Yeah.
A commodity.
That's right. I paid you to build out my wife for me in my memory, and you did it. And, you know, this is, it's real now. Here it is.
I think though that he's also, he's concerned about how people will remember her because the Vanner book makes her seem crazy. That's what he thinks. And so I think he is, I have more sympathy for him in the sense that I think he wants her to be remembered in a positive light rather than as a crazy person. Like it, well, the final perspective is that she's a crazy person.
I totally disagree with you.
Yeah, although there's some ambiguity about whether it's for her own sake or because of how a crazy wife reflects upon him.
This is so fun. This is exactly what the book is trying to do, you guys.
I don't think we can trust Ida even a little bit.
I totally agree.
What? What?
I don't think we can know what we can trust of her.
Do you mean part three or do you mean Ida?
What's the difference?
There's the reading between the lines, there's subtext and context. Like you can,
well, I think she wants us to read between the lines, but you can't know if you're reading for sure. If you're reading between the lines.
Yeah, but Hernan Diaz is writing part three. You know, in the voice of Ida.
I think you can trust Hernan Diaz.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, what are the potential evidences that Ida is not trustworthy? I'm granting she's got a perspective. No question whatsoever.
Yeah.
But it's another thing. And I would say Andrew Bevel has got a perspective.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
I would say the novelist has got a perspective. Well, but hold on. I trust you, Heidi, and you have a perspective.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So it's a difference. Know. Like there's one to say, shaded by the coloring of her perspective. I'm a little bit dubious about this thing or this thing is a very different statement than I do not trust Ida. And I trust Ida, but I totally recognize her perspective has colored her testimony like everybody's perspective has colored their testimony.
Right.
But David, it sounds like you're taking another step.
What's the difference between her approach in this part and the purpose of part two to Andrew Bevel?
I don't think that she has a foil that she is arguing against. She's not writing this to justify her behavior, to justify past decisions, polluting the market or whatever.
And that's where
she has motives, no doubt. But Andrew Bevel's autobiography is a justification of bad behavior. And I think everybody in the book is like, yeah. He seems like he did pretty nasty stuff, at least in the stock market, and maybe more. And it seems like his autobiography has a clear goal of undermining the novel because it appeared to get too close to the truth. I don't know what Ida's...
What do you think? Like, her tone to me seems just as self-justifying. If not to cover criminal behavior, to cover her rage against the way she feels men have treated her.
And a sense of shame about what she's done. Yeah.
Yes, and a sense of shame about what she's done. And that Bevel is representative of that in a way that she can't allow herself to feel about her dad.
Yeah.
I think that she is writing this section to as an apology in both senses of the word. I think I said that to you, Heidi, last night, for her behavior, for giving voice to this guy. Who over time she has come to
what she did despise. To her boyfriend was really despicable. And she justifies it. And attaches everything she feels about. And I think that's the purpose of him in the novel. Otherwise, he's just an extraneous character. Why is he even there? But she attaches this feeling of being controlled. And then she ships him off after internally accusing him of stealing from her without ever even asking him.
Wait, I'm a little confused. Maybe let's just, could we make sure we have the facts right on Jack?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
So when the guy comes to her and he's like, hey, you better tell me what you're doing with Andrew Bevel, I'll squeal.
The tieless man in the pinstripe suit.
Right.
That's true. Yeah, and he's working. Yeah,
and he's working for Jack.
Yes, and Jack was going to sell her out, but then she accused him of stealing the manuscript from her, and he didn't. And
her dad did.
Right,
but wasn't just a mistake on her part? I mean,
the attempted extortion was real.
But what I'm saying is, she's not any better than them.
Yeah.
Wait, and, wait, I'm understand. I don't understand. Why not? Because she's mad. Because she's mad at her dad and Andrew Bevel. I'm mad at her dad and Andrew Bevel.
Well,
their story.
I, like I said, I don't think there's any heroes, but I do not think she's a good person.
Tim's thinking.
Sean,
you could jump in.
I don't know that the question is Ida Pertenza a good person ever wholly occurred to me.
But that matters on whether you can trust her. It didn't necessarily to me either, but I only said that because I just used her actions and self-justifications as a reason why I don't trust her.
Fair enough.
And so that is a moral judgment on my part. And I'm not saying she's the worst. I'm saying everybody has a motive for obfuscation and for interpretations, and that we pick the ones we like.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I think that's a key thing. I think she is justifying giving voice to Bevel. I think she is justifying her participation in that project. We can go into that a little deeper. There's other stuff that there's other things that I don't think we could talk about until we get to part four, because I think there's things in part four that become clues.
Don't even tell me about part four.
Part four is pretty short, honestly. It won't take very long.
It's true.
It takes very long to read.
Reading it today.
I think that the book is also about, I think the, one of the reasons I don't trust her is because I think the book is telling us, it's telling us not to trust the people in this book.
Because
it's about the nature of fiction and the way that we tell stories about who we see ourselves as. That's a badly phrased sentence, but I think that
just for the record, I don't think so.
You don't think the book is telling us that?
I think that is an interpretive move on your part, and I don't think the book supports that. And I get that.
We'll have to write our essays and our counter essays on it.
We're trying to not until we get to the end of part four. I totally get that. Sean, sorry, I keep cutting you off today.
Well, no. I mean, I'm still not knowing what happens in part four. I'm a little bit in the blind still, but I thought about this question the last week or two, but this seems like the best place to ask it. I wasn't sure if it was worth asking before. And I don't know how extensive a conversation we even want to have about this because of where it can lead. But this is a universal novel in the sense that this is, David, the way you described it, is a universal concern. Right? What is the task of fiction and who can you trust? But is this a topical novel? I mean, is this like a fake news 2020s life in America/the world kind of a novel? I mean, is that why it won the Pulitzer Prize? Is that why he wrote it? Is that why we care? It's compelling. That's why I care about it. But
so Sean, if it was, is it like, it's topical because at the time of its writing, there was even deeper suspicion about the moneyed elites than there even usually is in the United States. This is pointing the finger at Andrew Bevel. The source of all of our travails is this kind of like shadowy figure who is a puppet master with financial machinations. And man, this book in this really sophisticated way, like finally gets back at the Andrew Bevels of the world. That would make it like kind of the moment. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Or even if it's not a hit piece on the Andrew Bevels of the world, but speaking into the moment where we're all concerned about the power of Andrew Bevels of the world to write their own stories.
I think it's playing on our suspicions of the Andrew Bevels.
Well, and also the journalistic outlets that tell us those stories, right? Everybody has their favorite their favorite outlet. And I think of like Yuri Berliner resigning from NPR in the last few weeks, saying this outlet that used to pride itself on being objective is an entirely partisan and I can't do it anymore. So is that a way to think about this novel, or like Heidi said, it did.
I think so.
One of the things it seems like it's trying to tell us is we choose the story that we choose the story we like. There's a confirmation bias in who we trust.
Can I add one more piece to this puzzle to just like to just make the strongest possible case that this might be a novel of the moment? This might be metafiction. I think it has a strong feminist message to it, I believe, just in the first three sections, a very strong feminist. And this is written, published around the time of like Me Too is kind of reaching its zenith. So that's another way in which you could say it might be, just kind of the moment. And it's really tapping into these kind of like, oh, this festering frustration in the public square and maybe even within us that these things are wrong. And finally a novelist is going to shish kebab, you know, the bad guys.
And but see, don't that's you think that's a bit too easy?
Well, right. If that's what that has seemed remarkable to me so far. If it is a novel of the moment, even with the concerns of these various characters and voices, the novelist has seemed not to commit in a compromising way to one position or another.
I totally agree.
So if part four were just to confirm that it's a feminist novel, that would be disappointing too. But I would be surprised if that happened at this point. You know more than I do, but don't tell me.
And I think that's why I'm pushing so hard on the Ida interpretation.
Yeah.
It is because if it is that, this is not that good of a book.
Yeah. No interpretation is supposed to be the interpretation thus far.
And I think that's why she's so morally complex, self-justifying in this section. And either Hernandez is too heavy-handed, or she's too heavy-handed. And this is what I was getting frustrated with last night when I was texting David. I'm like, this section's so heavy-handed. Like, it's just blah, blah, blah. And then David was like, well, what if you can't trust her? And I'm like, that makes it so much better.
The heavy-handedness, I think the part of the genius of this book is in a great novelist presenting these ideas and these perspectives in ways that seem one thing on the surface, but maybe they're not. And there's this line, Ida's whole conclusion that leads her to want to work on this book, the memoir for Bevel, is she says, maybe Vanner's book is true. Maybe the truth in Vanner's book is because of the distortions and the inaccuracies. And she keeps going back to this idea that what makes things true is not what's actually real. And so we can say, like somebody made an interesting comment that Bevel is, like Bevel's name is to like tell something, is to make something slant.
Oh yeah, that was a great
on the Substack. Someone commented on that, and I think that what she believes is that there's more truth in the slanted version of something than in just stating the facts. And the part of that is because of her, like that. That's first of all, I'll just say that's it's a really complex idea, and it's a really interesting one to contemplate in a novel which has books within books. It's like there's a Russian nesting doll of texts in this book. I mean, there's even like the stories her father tells within her story. And the story that Jack is going to send that she tells him is important. Like this section is all about how stories matter. And so she's telling a particular story and she believes that within the stories, it's the distortions and inaccuracies that most make a story true. In other words, that what's between the lines is what's most true. And I think that Diaz is taking that idea and playing with it. And so that what he wants us to do is be focusing ultimately not on what the central mystery is, but on what the things that are in the subtleties and in between the lines. And those are the clues that he wants us to direct us towards. Again, there's a lot we can't say until we get to part four.
I think that I agree with you almost the whole way. But I do think there is I think that we can trust the characters, and we have to trust the characters on the, like, the things that actually happened. Like, I don't think, for example, that I think the book falls apart if we try to undermine what happens in book four. Like the missing piece of the puzzle is the missing piece of the puzzle. I think we can question the interpretation of it, the people's motives, right? But like, even in part three, I don't fully trust her, but I think she's telling the truth about the things that happened. Like, I don't think she's making up that Andrew Bevel told her back the story of the mystery, or that her father said or did this or was a revolutionary, right?
Well, they made up the story to go in Bevel's book in the first place.
Okay, but do you know what I'm saying? Like, do you understand what I'm saying? That she's not lying about the things that happened. I think we have to trust, like, the right facts of this. Kind of like when you're reading, like, the Odyssey, and then people are like, well, maybe Odysseus made up his whole journeys. Like, just stop reading
Shut
then.
Up.
Like, just stop reading ever then. I think we do trust, like, that this happened this way, and that it's converging towards something. And I think we're given enough within the stories that the thing we're supposed to question are the people and the stories they're telling themselves. And so I'm trying to avoid is our listeners being like, why am I even reading this book if I can't trust anything and there's nothing true? Like, there is a reason to read. There is a thing that's happening. There is a plot. There is an objective series of facts that this is converging towards. And the meta narrative questions are about the perceptions of the people of the events.
I agree with that. That sounds pretty different from what was said earlier. I thought the assertion earlier was, this is really about a reader response than it's about any sort of veracity.
No, I think that there's something that actually, like, we know that, for example, Mildred Bevel did not die of of insanity and shock treatments, right? What we don't know, though, is why Harold Vanner told that story, and that actually matters, right?
Yeah.
We know she died of cancer instead. We know that we have these objective facts, like the fact that her room is different, like her room reveals a different kind of person. So we can trust the fact that Mildred is not this, like, shrinking violet wife that Andrew Bevel wants her to be, which is not just being filtered through Ida's perceptions. We have some actual facts in the story to trust, to put our weight on, so that we know that she really is, that Mildred's character still is a mystery. And now we're going to have her words, right? So I do think that there are some things that are actually happening. There is a plot. This isn't all just meta narrative. Like, there is a real thing that's happening. But I do not think that we have to trust any of the characters' perceptions of those events. But I think we have to accept that the events happened.
Tim is nodding.
Yeah, I'm content with that.
Tim's ready. Tim's formulated.
Well, how do I we're getting into like really subtle epistemic ground here, because let's imagine a scenario. Let's imagine that Sean is recounting, you know, walking down the sidewalk and a dog bites him and he gets really mad at the dog. And Sean recounts this to us. We believe everything that Sean is telling us. And when Sean tells us how angry he is, we know that his anger drove the telling, shaped the telling of the narrative, and influenced what Sean remembered, what he omitted. And I don't think that makes his testimony untrue. I just think like his emotional response shaped his telling. And I think that that is true of sections both 2 and 3.
Right.
I just don't think we know about number 1. I think because we don't meet the author or the novelist, we just get little scraps here and there about him. But I think that's true about 2 and 3. And yeah, so.
But if Sean, I agree with you, but if Sean said like that rock jumped down and bit me, right? Like that, like we would know that that interpretation came because he was angry. Right.
Right.
And
right.
So being able to perceive that emotional response on his part, sorry, Sean.
That's fine.
And gives, like, we don't have to take him at face value that this rock maliciously made him trip. Right. And I think we do have some evidence that there's some evidence in the text that that's happening with Ida specifically and with Bevel in his perceptions of his family. Right. Like, so understanding their emotional state impacts how they tell the story.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, if that's all we're asserting, then I'm fine with it. But like the claims that like, I don't believe what Ida says, that's where I was like, wait.
I don't believe what she says about Bevel. I believe that she is reporting the things that happened, but I do not believe that he has to be the evil Pygmalion capitalist that she is claiming that he is. Just because she says that he is.
So Heidi, can I ask you about an example then? It's unclear to me which category it fits in.
Mm-hmm.
When Ida finds definitive proof, and some of it is coming after the fact when she's an older woman, but she has definitive proof that Mildred Bevel is way, way into modern music.
Mm-hmm.
What we would call modern classical music, because that's, we have no categories. And her husband says, oh, no. She wasn't really into that stuff. And let's not talk about her being into that stuff. Is that a detail that she's faithfully reporting about him?
Yes.
Or, okay.
Yeah.
But also the other thing?
What do you mean?
But also that she, but a way that she is casting him as this, you know, evil Pygmalion-esque.
I think we are allowed to make our own interpret. Like, I don't like Bevel. I don't think he's a good man, right? Again, yeah. We're at the moral judgments. I think we have plenty of evidence in the text that she is interpreting him through her own emotions about him, right?
Pointing back to what Tim said about her father.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
But the fact that Mildred is different than Bevel's perspective of her is certainly true.
It's true.
Because okay. we have corroborating evidence for that right. This is my whole point about what David's comment is. We have to be able to have that in the story to put our trust in those things, not just Ida's perceptions. Like for me, the reason I know that Mildred is different than what she's is because we have these corroborating evidence, not just because Ida says so. Yeah. And Ida wants it to be true. Like for her to take that diary at the end is like the height of, like, you can't do that.
That makes her like you suspect her, like she's a bad person because she did that?
Okay, I've already said I don't like her and that I don't think she's a good person. My point is that her perception of that, she justifies it. Mildred would have wanted me, right? But what I'm saying is I see Mildred different, not because of those claims that Ida makes, but because we have like real evidence in the story that Mildred is different than Ida says. Than Bevel says. So we have like the documented evidence. We have the fact that her room is so different, right? We have corroborating details that deepens this mystery that you were talking about. And what I'm saying is that we have to be able to put our trust in that. I don't have to put my trust in Ida's perceptions.
Yeah. What's funny, and it's just kind of occurring to me in this moment, is that Ida, in her account, sort of manages to do, and I don't know if this is intentional on some level, she sort of manages to do what every man in her story aspires and fails to do.
Mm-hmm.
Jack's aspirations, she realizes for herself.
That's right.
If this account, depending on how you take it, is a way of more successfully undermining the world that her father hated and tried to undermine without much success. And then even the telling the story of Andrew Bevel is the thing that Andrew Bevel wanted to do, right? And she does it instead. And I don't know how successfully then she is able to also tell the story of Mildred, but I don't know if anybody actually wanted to do that. The men in her life maybe didn't really want to do that.
Well, and that's where taking the journal is really interesting and
that's right.
Like, deeply ironic because in her perspective, Mildred's this person that she's the only one who can unlock the cipher that is her journals. She's going to spend all this time figuring out what these experts couldn't figure out how to read her writing and all that kind of stuff. And what she really needs to do is, if she really wants to give voice to this character, to Heidi's point, you don't take it and hide it. Like, you don't, she doesn't even include that in her book, right? She takes it for herself. She doesn't give voice to this woman who she ostensibly thinks she's giving voice to. And so...
Wait, she doesn't?
I mean, it's hard to... Unclear, I guess.
Are we talking about part four? That's what part four is?
Part four is not part of her book. Part four is part of this book. Part four is the same independent part, just like Vanner's novel.
I don't know what part four is, y'all.
Well, it says it in the title page.
It's true. So is that, I mean,
but
that's...
But part four, nobody has access to part four in the book but Ida. It's gone. It's like... in the stacks of like never to be discovered again.
But no one is also has the same of part two then.
Is that the context for part one? Do we know? I haven't actually read into part four. Is it that Ida, is part four Ida reading it by herself? Or is part four, light of day?
Well, we're told that the journals are labeled Futures by Mildred Bevel. And part four is Futures. That's
right,
the title of it.
But what I mean is there's no way to know.
We can't tell you, Sean.
Okay. But
read between the lines.
But what I'm saying,
we can tell people this. It's not.
There's no way to know.
A spoiler.
Yeah.
If part four is just the journal, then there's no way to know whether we receive part four with the understanding that Ida has published it and everyone has read part four, or that Ida is sitting alone in the apartment that the Bevel estate is still paying for. I don't know. reading it by herself.
I think the question that we're even discussing here is the point of the book, because it goes back to what Tim used the idea. You brought up the idea of epistemology. Metafiction, in my opinion, by definition, is about the epistemology of fiction. It's like, how do you think about what you learn and understand? And I don't mean learn like, ooh, I learn how to be a better person. I mean, how you know through fiction, how you interpret, how you see, how you feel, how you access, how you experience, how you trust. And so I think this is a book that is on every page asking us to think about how we think about the nature of fiction. And if you don't want to think about that, you don't have to think about it, which is why this book works. If you don't ever want to think about the metafiction aspects of it, and you just, or epistemology, or the philosophy of money, or anarchism or capitalism, you can just read it as a story. It can, and at the end, you can be like, oh, that was kind of interesting. And you can do that. But it also is asking us to think about things on a much deeper level. And it rarely gives us the actual answer, in my opinion, because it's asking us, it's by the nature of its, the whole form of it, is it's asking us to think about how we think about these things. And that's why we're stuck on this conversation that we're having, you know, we're,
right. And I want to go back before we end and say, I think every single thing I'm saying about Ida in part three, I also believe to be true about Andrew Bevel in part two and Harold Vanner in part one.
Yeah.
And Mildred Bevel in part four. I am not just I'm not trying to indict Ida. That's just the part we're talking about.
I agree with you. Yeah. I think this part focuses that question.
Right. I think so, for sure. And I think it's very important that part two is written by Ida, which has another layer, right? But it is the story that Andrew Bevel wants to tell. And we obviously know we can't trust that story.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is,
why can't we not trust Ida's? Of course we cannot trust it. Same with Mildred's and same with Harold Vanner's. We already know we can't trust Harold Vanner's story.
Because it's a novel,
right? And so to your point, that's the point of fiction. And fiction in a novel, you could say whatever you want, even if it's a fictionalized historical fiction. For example, that Richard the Third killed his nephews, which clearly he didn't, which I have
he
just
did. Learned he was a bad
from guy. Yeah. Time. But
Inspector Grant solved that one.
Exactly. But to your point that a couple of you have made, why does Harold Vanner want to tell that story?
Right? I don't know.
And that, like, the stories that we tell ourselves, the stories we tell our world, the stories that the images we project, the stories that are on the national level, like about we're talking about the stock market, like the nature of fiction, that's a big deal. But like the accusation is that one guy caused the Great Depression, right? and that hasn't been.
Which seems a bit crazy.
That keeps coming back, right? And it's a major question of the book, actually. So this is everything I'm saying about, this isn't about Ida is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's about the whole novel. But I think to your point, Tim, and I don't know if this is your point or not, I think we have an actual story, not just a meditation on stories, but I think we have a real story that is culminating towards something. And part four, that's actually really cool.
But I would argue if we don't have a story because people aren't telling the truth, that's still a story.
That's the story.
Yeah. And I think that's too convoluted. And I think that what's the point of reading that then? I think you're too meta on that.
I'm going to be grumpy if that's the story.
Yeah, I think you're too meta on if that's the direction you go also. I think you're just like forcing
David just doesn't
the
like
novel.
Firmed, fixed
you're forcing
things.
The novel to conform to a genre that's printed on the back cover, which
I don't agree. I haven't been able to go into all the evidence yet.
Next week.
But also I'm saying that last point that I just made there, I don't even know how I phrased it anymore. That's not my whole argument. I'm just saying that's like floating in the air.
Yeah, but I think there's a real story. I think there has to be a real story.
Man, not only is part four going to unlock the mystery of the book, it's going to unlock the mystery of what you guys actually think. I can't wait.
Okay. We didn't even talk about the passages on the philosophy of money, which is a really important part of this. And then also, there is a lot of passages on here on the nature of fiction and mysteries that we could have gone into. Sean, is there anything in this section that stood out to you that we didn't get to that's been like a lingering question for you? Or just an interesting moment or passage or whatever?
I mean, some of the kinds of passages you just mentioned, but I feel like our conversation has involved the spirit of what they were about and that they overlap some, right? That much of what Bevel says about the nature of money is really that money can make a fiction into a truth, right? That you can bend and adjust reality. And
which is not that far actually from what her father says too.
It's true. Yeah. Or like what he, especially that scene where he tells her what he has done to Harold Vanner and says something like, why should there be references to Harold Vanner if Harold Vanner didn't exist? Which is very much, if there's any ambiguity in other places, that is a villainous line. Right.
Absolutely.
Sure.
But maybe he had, I mean, depending again on what is true about Mildred and why Harold Vanner did what he did, maybe we'll come back around and say, gosh, yeah, I hate that Harold Vanner guy. I'm with Bevel in that moment. Maybe not.
Heidi, what about you? As far as my last question, are there any passages, moments, lines, whatever that stood out that we didn't really get to or that you're just thinking about?
No, I mean, I think there's a lot more that we haven't talked about. I mean, the question of money is central to the book, but we'll have plenty of opportunities to talk about that moving forward.
It's a pretty long section, actually. Like this is basically a third of, almost half the book, page-wise. page count was. Tim, what about you?
I'm excited to read 4 again. That was really profound. Like such a profound insight. Tim, wow. Thanks for being on the show today. That was awesome.
Well, no, really, thanks for being on the show, because we don't end up usually getting that many chances to argue with each other about stuff. And people right. like yeah,
this, argue has been a, this has been a fiery so one.
It's always good when we can, you know. But I think that's the point.
I totally agree. I love it.
So, okay. Next week, we will discuss part 4.
The whole book.
And the whole book. And then we'll do the Q&A episode.
Sean, will you text us?
Yeah, immediately.
Off the air when you finish it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I will.
I've got theories that are probably not even appropriate for the show. They're so out there. So I'll just keep those to the text.
Yeah, I do. I do want to just talk about the book and accept the book. I really do.
I'm with you. I'm ready. Maybe. I don't know how ready I am. I'm so nervous.
So nervous.
He's get off, go read it right now. It'll take you about 20 minutes. Literally, it'll take like 20 minutes. All right, well, let's wrap this up. Don't forget about all the stuff we got going on at Close Reads. We have the mystery novels. We got our Christian Lovren's Daughter series over at Close Reads HQ. We have the daily poem, of course. Tim, what's up with you? What's up with the Plays the Thing right now?
Right now, our most recent offering on the Plays the Thing, your one-stop podcast for all things Shakespeare, is nice. The four of us talking about King John a little bit, but really talking about the history of the podcast, because it's the last play.
Oh, yeah. You've covered all of them.
We've covered all of them.
That was a fun day when we recorded that.
I know. Yeah. That was good.
So it's worth a listen. Even if you don't know anything about King John, or you don't think it's Shakespeare's best work, you'd be correct. It's a really good listen. I did a little review of it the last couple of days, and I was like, oh, this is a great episode.
So shelf that's up banter. Now.
It's up right now.
Top shelf banter.
Okay. Top shelf.
We also have Withy Wendell back if you're interested in that. Your family is. Now, last thing I want to say is, as of today, this has already been posted online, but we have a whole bunch of, we're in the middle of a Close Read swag drop. We have Sweet Show Swag, I believe is what we once referred to it as. We've got some t-shirts and some things like that are available for you to purchase. And so that's going to be a 1 week thing. So on Friday, cutting it off, whatever people have ordered during that time, that's what we're going to get and send out. We're going to order from our printer what people ordered, and we're not going to have a lot of extra. And that's it's your one window for now to order. So hop to it if you want something.
David, what's the update on Lumen?
It's being copied. It's in being copy edited right now. So it's still on target to get shipped in the summer, whatever. I don't remember what date she said, but it's coming along. Looks good.
And how do people get a hold of it if they haven't already?
They can go to goldberryarts.com. Or goldberrybooks.com and click the little link. But goldberryarts.com is the place. And we're still doing, I think as of today, we still have some free shipping available on that if you order now. Right. So
we ordered it for our school. We're going to be teaching it as the curriculum at our forest school. What? We can't wait.
Nice.
Yeah,
Bethany's been talking to a couple of different people about schools and co-ops and how it could work for that. So it's that stage right now where it's like the final touches and the final trying to make sure everything is like, the T's are
beautiful.
The T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. To go back to to Ida's book.
And yeah, thanks money for asking. Is the commodity that rules everything. So
exactly. There were a lot of references to painters in this book that might not show up in Lumen. So, well, with that, let's wrap this up. Thanks to Logan for making it sound better. Thanks to all of you for subscribing and listening and telling your friends and leaving comments and being a part of the conversation in the community. For Tim McIntosh, for Heidi White, and for Sean Johnson, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, happy reading.